East Germany is throwing open its borders with West Germany, a move which effectively signals the end of the Berlin Wall.
I come from East Berlin. First time tonight. Yes? In half hour. Wonderful.
The fall of communism changed the shape of our continent. The accession of 10 new members from the former communist bloc is now decisively changing the European Union. It's no longer the loose trading alliance of Western European neighbours that Britain signed up to 40 years ago. Its centre of gravity has moved dramatically to the east. I'm Alan Little, and in Europe Moves East on the BBC World Service, I'm going to look at the consequences of that night of euphoric celebration in November 1989.
I cannot believe in it.
This is history. She's crying. This is it.
Divided, post-war Germany had been a much diminished force in Europe. It had been humbled and subdued by history. Now, suddenly, the prospect of reunification brought an old question back into the affairs of the continent. The German question. How to make Europe safe from an overbearing Germany? Britain opposed immediate reunification. Sir John, now Lord Kerr, is a former UK ambassador to the EU.
It was British policy that there should be a sort of 10-year period in which an independent East Germany was brought up to speed alongside the other countries of Eastern Europe and then could join the European Union and Germany. Kohl had no truck with such nonsense and went straight ahead, unification as fast as possible, even at immense cost to West Germany through the merger of the on one-to-one basis of the Ostmark and the Deutschmark. His second decision was even braver in a way. And that was that it was going to be the disappearance of the inner German frontier, but no other frontiers were going to change. My colleagues in the German diplomatic service all seemed to be from East Prussia, whose lands had been confiscated in 45. And to a man, they knew that Kohl was right.
It was ice cold winter. The roads were full with misery. I felt deeply ashamed, but not about my own fate. It was more about the German army running away in the wrong direction.
The German diplomat Dietrich von Kiel was 10 years old when Germany lost the war. He'd been raised on his family's estate in Pomerania in eastern Germany. In 1945, as the Red Army approached, his family fled west. When the map of Europe was redrawn, his family home, their land and property for generations, would be in Poland.
There were wagons, horse-drawn wagons, coming from what was really Poland, the areas where Hitler had tried to create a mix, and now these people were coming. And then these poor people dying in the ditches.
Dietrich von Kiel's generation was shaped by that experience. In the decades after the war, they worked to make peace with their country's old enemies, to bind West Germany's fate inseparably with that of its neighbours to the west. Now, in 1989, they saw a chance to do the same with their neighbours to the east.
In 1990, I was sent to Prague to advise the Czechoslovak government at that time on how to work out an association with the EU. We sent members of our ministry to the capitals of our major neighbours, that is Warsaw, Prague, and Budapest, in order to advise them how to prepare full membership.
Why was Germany so keen to make those contacts?
We needed stability in the area between us and Russia. And we had learned, living in the center of Europe and not on an island.
Germany was becoming again a country in the middle, no more a front country, but a country in the middle.
For Joachim Bitterlich, it transformed Germany's place in Europe.
Nine neighbors around us. Towards the west, we had reached peace. And our chance at that moment was to be surrounded by friends for the first time in history. We had this, let's say, history twice broken in the last century. First from the Empire to the Weimar Republic, then Hitler, the whole experience with the Nazi regime, then the division of Germany, and suddenly this chance to come back.
It wasn't only Britain that was unnerved by Germany's chance to come back. France was also worried. The French had felt comfortable in their familiar partnership with a diminished West Germany, with its quiet capital at Bonn on the Belgian border. A united Germany governed from Berlin and forging new partnerships to its east would be far less amenable to French influence.
The pavement cafes of Paris are a reminder of how pleasant and civilized urban life can be. And they remind you also that Paris really is the capital of a certain conception of the way European life should be. A social market economy carefully regulated to protect a certain way of life, social welfare, minimum wages, employment protection. When the European community was a West European affair with a handful of members, France could project those values onto the continent as a whole. But after the euphoria of the liberation of Eastern Europe wore off, the consequences brought huge anxiety to these safe, protected, very French Parisian streets.
The fear was more that it would dilute the European Union.
Elisabeth Guigou was President Mitterrand's Europe Minister in the early 1990s, when EU membership for the Central European countries was first proposed. General de Gaulle had twice vetoed British membership, partly because he feared that the British would bring the Trojan horse of American values and American influence into the European citadel. The French now thought the same of the former communist countries.
It was the biggest enlargement ever, and very close as well to the United States of America, of course, considering that the NATO was the only protection for them, which we could understand, of course.
Was it a fear that it would bring in a greater American influence into the European Union?
Yes, greater American influence, both on the political field and on the economic field.
Free market.
A free market. Our conception of the European Union is that certainly it has a free market and it's a very good thing and we should make more progress towards that, provided it has common rules and that this free market is completed by common policies. What we feared was that with the Eastern countries, there would be a shift of influence with more countries who consider the European Union as a mere exchange zone and nothing else.
And those East European countries, it became clear, tended to look to Britain and America as their model rather than to France or even Germany.
Exactly.
Many new member states, like Poland, saw the European Union above all as a liberating force, a way of locking themselves into a secure and democratic family of nations, and finally, after centuries, making Europe safe for Poland to be securely Poland. In the 80s, Radoslaw Sikorski spent 8 years in exile in Britain. Today, he's Poland's foreign minister.
For us, it was the ultimate institutional confirmation that we are a regular European country, a status of which we were deprived against our will by the two totalitarian powers, Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany. For us, the Second World War and its political consequences only ended in some sense in 1989 when we had our first free elections, and really and truly only after we joined NATO and the EU.
For Sikorski, the problem has not been that the European Union has grown too strong and too centralised, but that the central institutions are not strong enough, that Brussels has lacked the power to force member nations to live by the rules they've agreed to.
The problem with the Eurozone was that treaties were not enforced, that rules were breached when their observance depended only on the goodwill of member states. And, of course, that included the biggest ones too. So in order to make the EU work, we need stronger rules.
So you have to further curtail national sovereignty, in a sense.
Well, there are areas in which we have, including Britain, given up national sovereignty altogether. For example, in the trade area, because size matters in politics. As the EU as a whole, we are able to negotiate with China, with the United States, with Brazil, as equals.
And Poland seems to me to be at the forefront of arguing now that this needs to go further, that we need to deepen the European project.
Yes, because part of the rationale behind the EU was actually similar to NATO's. It was, to some extent, a Cold War institution. West Europeans were getting together because they feared the Soviet Union. That petrol is spent. But what we now have is an opportunity to matter more in the world, in which we are becoming a smaller proportion of population, a smaller proportion of the economy, if we stick together.
Last week we had a kind of a storm here, and then pieces of...
7 years ago, Jörg Müller-Kindt started a software design company called Networked Assets. It's grown year on year ever since. Jörg is in his early 40s. The West Germany he grew up in was a frontline state in the 40-year armed standoff between the Soviet Union and the Western democracies. He, too, is shaped by his country's historical experience.
I grew up in Western Germany, close to the border of Luxembourg in Trier, which was basically growing up on an aircraft carrier, because you had the large American bases around Spandau, Hahn and Rammstein, and we had the largest French garrison outside of France, 20,000 French soldiers being stationed there, Pershing rockets and NATO Doppelbeschluss, I don't know the English word for that. That was my growing up phase in the 80s.
And those Pershing missiles were nuclear, they carried nuclear warheads.
Yeah, and the French basically had a scorched earth policy. They basically told us, if the Russians ever send tanks across the border, they would burn everything where we lived for 200 kilometers just to have a strip of scorched earth where the tanks would have to roll through before they could get to France. That is something you grew up with.
And so this enlargement represents what? The inclusion of Poland and the other East European countries represents what for a man of your generation?
The European Union is the only thing that stands between us and the darkness. There has been quite a shadow above my generation. Immediate fear of this nuclear deterrent, which was part of daily life all through the 80s and 70s, it's not there anymore, and it's freedom.
The European Union is the only thing that stands between us and the darkness. That belief that European integration has delivered the nations of the continent from their appalling histories is powerful and tenacious in Central Europe. And it's a belief shared by Germans and Poles. In both countries, history is the unseen guest at every conference table. In both countries, the dead of past conflicts reach out to speak through the voices of the living.
I'm standing on the banks of the River Oder, looking right up a six-lane highway, a very busy road that cuts through the heart of the city of Wrocław. In the last desperate weeks of the Second World War, the Germans holding out here demolished all the buildings on each side of the road in order to turn this highway into an aircraft runway to try to keep the city supplied as the Red Army approached. It didn't work. The city fell in the end anyway, and the airport that was built here by forced labour was never used. And standing here is a reminder that the old European community of the 1950s and 60s and 70s was built by those who had survived the war on the Western Front. The European Union that exists now is being shaped increasingly by those who survived the war on the much more brutal Eastern Front, and then went on to survive 40 years of Soviet occupation.
Today, in the reunited Germany, Jörg and his business partner Gregor Koppi look not west, but east. Gregor's family fled communist Poland when he was 15, and they settled in Germany. Now he's gone back. Networked Assets have opened a branch of their company here in Wrocław. This, the Polish end of their business, is also rapidly growing.
For us, it was more of a return home, because Gregor's family is from Wrocław. So his grandmother is still living there, and the whole enlarged family. What we were always aware of is that the level of education, especially in computer science and mathematics, is very, very good, and I would say even better in Poland, Ukraine and Russia, White Russia for that matter, than it is in Germany. So we knew that there are good people from our field in Poland. Wrocław is one of the centers of computer science education in Poland. All the large system integrators are there. Siemens, you have Tieto, you have Volvo Systems, Capgemini, whatever.
And is it the case that you can characterize the relationship like this? Poland provides the skilled workforce that you need at relatively low prices, relatively low wages, whereas Germany and other parts of the European Union provide the customers?
Yes, till today. Actually, today we are talking to a new employee who is going to start sales in Poland. and Poland is becoming a market, which is true for most of Eastern Europe, and you have an infrastructure that is basically brand new.
As Germany has lost some trade with Southern Europe, as the Southern European economies have run into trouble, it has certainly gained trade with Eastern Europe. And really, the Germans were the ones who figured out how to make money in the region. They have the right size companies. They have middle-sized companies, which have been able to find partners in Poland and in the Czech Republic and Slovakia.
Anne Applebaum is a historian of Russia and Eastern Europe and the author of Iron Curtain, an account of the post-war Soviet takeover in the east of the continent.
The transformation of Germany has changed everything in Eastern Europe because it's changed the pole of attraction. You know, those countries, instead of doing what they did before the war, which was make unstable alliances with one another and, frankly, unreliable alliances with England and France, they now see that by maintaining a close, particularly a close trade relationship, but also a political relationship with Germany, by having open borders with Germany, they have immediate access to German markets, they have access to German investment. They are part of Germany's influence on the world.
The European project began in the 1950s as an attempt to Europeanize Germany, to contain a power that had twice in living memory laid waste to the continent. But Germany is no longer humbled and subdued, for the center of gravity in Europe has shifted dramatically to the east. Lord Kerr.
When that sleepy little town, Bonn, on the Rhine, very close to France, was locked and left, and people moved to Berlin, which is very close to Poland. That took the centre of gravity of the European Union, economically, politically, not just geographically, a long way east. Well, it shifted northeast. I'm not thinking so much about the Baltic states, but if you think about Finland, Poland, Sweden, these are countries with 600, 700 years of shared history. They are very close.
Poland is the only country in the EU that has not had a recession in the last 5 years. Its economy has continued to grow, and with it, its weight in Europe grows too. It's the sixth largest member state by population, nearly 40 million people. It leads a group of 10 former communist states whose combined population is close to 100 million. European affairs, once driven by a Franco-West German motor, revolve increasingly around a Berlin-Warsaw axis. Poland's Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski is clear about how he would like the European Union to develop.
We would like the European Union to become a superpower, in the words of Tony Blair. On the global scene, we are all, whether Poland or Britain, small countries. Some of us know it, others are yet to find out. Only as the European Union as a whole can we maintain the influence of the West as a whole.
Poland is in no doubt about the country it thinks should step forward in this current crisis. The Poles have buried their ancient enmity with Germany, their old entrenched suspicions about German domination. And now they actively want Germany to lead, actively press Germany to be more muscular in guiding Europe out of its current mess. It is Germany itself, plagued by its own history, that is nervous about German leadership. Joachim Bitterlich.
It's a difficult position for the Germans, because from 1989-90, they had to learn something which they had totally forgotten. Responsibility and leadership.
In Europe?
In Europe. After the Second World War, the Germans had learned to be humble, to shut up if necessary, because they were not the best in leadership in the past, saying the diplomatic way. They had to learn it again.
No wonder the French are nervous. The old European community was their creation. French was its language. What has happened to the Franco-German motor? Dietrich von Kiel believes French influence is waning and that that makes Germany again uncomfortably powerful in Europe.
What I'm worried about is the growing cleavage between German economic performance and French. Because the nuclear bomb of our times is the economy. And where are the reforms in France? They have to get their act together economically. It's not enough to become the leader of the southern rim of the European Union.
And more, what will happen is the real power, which, as you say, is not nuclear weapons anymore, it's the economy, is going to shift to the east.
and group itself around this dynamic new axis between Berlin and Warsaw.
Yeah, but this is very dangerous for Germany. This will bring, in a different way, the German question up again.
So, this is what it is. Looks like a monastery, doesn't it? We have this.
Mateusz Kornacki shows me into a beautiful cloistered courtyard in the heart of the Polish city of Wrocław. He's 26 and a guide in this city, and he clearly loves every brick and stone of it, especially this former monastery, which houses the renowned Ossolineum Library of Polish Literature. It's a national treasure. But it hasn't always been here, for until 1945, this city wasn't in Poland at all. It was the German city of Breslau.
So this library moved west in a way that mirrors the movement of Poland itself. Poland moved to the west.
It was one of the first cultural institutions that was arranged in Wrocław, along with the people who came here after the Second World War. They came to a former German city, well, probably felt huge hate to Germans, and they were not really feeling comfortable living in the city that didn't really describe any connection with Polish culture or Polish identity, and everything around was German. And apart from the people that we moved some cultural resources as well, just to make ourselves feel more comfortable, probably, by moving resources as well, not only the people.
The library was originally in Lvov, a city of multiple identities. It was once a German-speaking city called Lemberg. After the First World War, it was part of Poland, and since 1945, it's been known as Lviv, and it's in Ukraine.
We come back to the Polish history, and if we come back to the 19th century, where we were ripped by three neighbour countries and we disappeared from the map of Europe, and then move along to the 20th century, we experienced communism, that our social life and our economy was cracked by that. At the end of the 20th century, we finally become a democratic country, and we were never feeling so safe about our future, you know? And probably I represent the first generation of people who don't have to fight for Poland, and we can just focus on building Poland, you know? Things that Western Europe got used to throughout last decades is still pretty fresh for us.
Europe is shaped by its history. The idea of the continent has moved east. The EU that is emerging is shaped by the experience of the Eastern Front and by 40 years of Soviet oppression. The EU the Central Europeans want is something much more than an open trading bloc. They want it to be a bedrock for their infant democracies and for their security. Europe Moves East on the BBC World Service was presented by me, Alan Little, and produced by Jane Beresford.